Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Journey to Success Radio Network. Our purpose on Journey to Success Radio is to interview people who are making a positive difference in the world. We explore important aspects and areas of life, including business, sales, spiritual, physical, mental, relationships, disabilities, and many more interesting topics. Our broadcast team so far consists of outstanding people from both Canada and the U.S., including several Napoleon Hill Foundation certified instructors, as well as several authors. My name is Tom Tuttle Cunningham, and I'm a Napoleon Hill Foundation certified instructor. I'm also a regular contributor to their weekly newsletter, and in March of 2012, I spoke at the Napoleon Hill International Convention in Malaysia, where I shared the stage with Deepak Chopra, who was a keynote speaker for that event. I've had rheumatoid arthritis from my jaw to my toes since the age of 5. That's 44 years now, and in that time, I've had 4 hips, 4 knees, and 2 shoulders replaced, and been hospitalized about 40 times. I also stand about 5'1". That's due to the heavy daily doses of the oral steroid prednisone that I had to take to fight my arthritis. And yet, despite those physical challenges, I'm well known for always answering amazing when I was asked how I'm doing. I'm also a senior editorial researcher for the Canadian Business Journal. We're a digital-only publication, and we're the official and only media partner of the Canadian Chamber of Commerce. You can find out more about me at my website. It's mrpma.ca. That's mrpma.ca. My guest today is Vern Harnish. Vern is founder of the world-renowned Entrepreneurs Organization and chaired for 15 years EO's premier CEO program, The Birthing of Giants, as well as WEO's Advanced Business Executive Program, both held at MIT. He's the founder and CEO of Gazelles, which is a global executive education and coaching company. Vern has spent the past 30 years educating entrepreneurial teams. The Growth Guy syndicated columnist. He's also the venture columnist for Fortune magazine. He's the author of Mastering the Rockefeller Habits, which I've read, is an amazing book. It is endorsed by over 100 CEOs of mid-sized companies and is published in Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Russian, Serbian, Polish, Dutch, German, and Spanish. Vern, along with the editors of Fortune, has also authored The Greatest Business Decision of All Times, for which Jim Collins wrote the foreword. Vern also chairs annual growth summits in North America, Australia, Europe, and Latin America, and continues to teach in the MIT-based executive program he founded and the Taipan Making of Asian Giants program he co-chaired for 10 years. He also led the first delegation of young entrepreneurs to mainland China and currently resides in Barcelona, Spain. He's married with 4 children and enjoys piano, tennis, and magic as a card-carrying member of the International Brotherhood of Magicians. Welcome to the show, Vern.
Hey, glad to be here.
Wow, I love the International Brotherhood of Magicians. Very cool.
Yeah, IBM, as we're known. It's been a fun hobby.
I had a friend who actually in Toronto here went to Clown College when he was in his late 20s, and he's been able to entertain kids and adults alike for years with the various interesting tricks he's learned. So that's kind of a fun thing that you do. Now,
yeah,
Vern, I
have to fall back on.
Yeah, something you could do part-time.
Exactly. Yeah, if this gig doesn't work out with the Gazelles, I can go entertain kids at birthday parties.
Exactly. Now, my first exposure to you was maybe about 4 or 5 years ago when I read Mastering the Rockefeller Habits. And as you know, I'm a Napoleon Hill Foundation certified instructor, and Napoleon Hill wrote a lot about Rockefeller. He spoke about him very well and fairly frequently. And so when I saw the title, I read the book and, wow, I loved it because I've been worked in a for a management consultant for 4 years, and so I love processes and systems and metrics. And you do for big companies, or you do for smaller entrepreneurial companies, what management consultants might do for a ginormous billion-dollar company: put proper systems and processes and metrics into the hands of entrepreneurs and small business people. And so tell me a little bit about that book, because that's the one that I really, really am fond of.
Well, you know, I, Tom, was a huge fan of Napoleon Hill as well. My dad introduced him to me and his work back, I was, you know, 13, 14 years old, which is, you know, about 40 years ago. And, you know, we had the whole tape series, and I'd listen to it over and over and over. And so I heard a lot about Rockefeller and had kind of tracked his career. And then let's speed forward, about 1999, a good friend of mine gave me a copy of Titan, which is the big biography that came out on John D. Rockefeller. And I dug into it, and I'm like, wow, you know, here's the wealthiest guy ever on the planet. I mean, you take Carlos Slim and Ortega, now the third wealthiest guy from Spain here with Zara, and add Bill Gates. The three of those guys together would almost equal John D. Rockefeller's wealth. And he was a young entrepreneur. You know, he was a guy that started, you know, basically, you know, got into business when he was 16, and age 20, he and his brother and some guys got, you know, essentially what is became Standard Oil started. And he spoke deeply about some things that were key to him being able to compete in what was a very turbulent industry. I really thought and saw, Tom, that what John D. Rockefeller was going through was pretty much what we were going through in the late 90s, 2000, 2001. But instead of it being a tech bubble, it was an oil bubble. 1,000 refineries kind of popped up overnight and died like dot-coms. And kind of out of the dust emerged this young entrepreneur, John D. Rockefeller. And I think as historians have seen and have pointed out, that all the real wealth tends to be made kind of in the second wave. So the first wave, you got this just a lot of activity, and then it's the disciplined entrepreneurs in the second wave that are really able to take advantage of it. And so I thought he was a perfect analogy for what we were going through right there during the dot-com bust, and wrote the book.
Amazing, and a tremendous book. And now you mentioned being exposed to Napoleon Hill at age 13 from your dad. Wow, did your dad, was he an entrepreneur, small business person as well? Because that would be, I would think that'd be quite a gift to learn about Napoleon Hill at age 13 rather than if you're in your 30s or 40s or 50s. And to have it taught to you or recommended to you by your father, wow, not every father recommends Think and Grow Rich to their kids.
Yeah, he was a partner in he was part of the whole space race out with Martin Marietta, grew up in Littleton, Colorado, and he and three of his buddies broke loose and launched an early tech company. I was actually there when they first animated Mickey Mouse. You know, the animators were having to do it all by hand, and there was a company that used computers just outside of Littleton to animate. So we were all in that whole tech space, and he was quite a learner himself. So two books. It was Napoleon Hill's work and Schwartz's The Magic of Thinking Big were kind of the two books that I grew up on.
David Schwartz, The Magic of Thinking Big. I just reread it last year, read it over 20-some years ago. A very, very powerful book. It really impacted me as well. So those are two good ones to start with. And then when you start with those at a young age, then you're already thinking, probably even before you finish school, about being an entrepreneur, small business person. And not everybody sitting in school as a young kid thinks of that as a possibility and a career. So now we know where you are today.
And let me comment on that. It was interesting. And in 83, when I co-founded ACE, Association of Collegiate Entrepreneurs, that led to me launching YEO, you know, it was interesting. It was not actually cool to be an entrepreneur. we're still in that kind of corporate world where parents' reaction to their college students thinking about launching a business was, you know, that's cute, you know, neat that you're doing it during college, but when are you going to get a real job? And
yeah.
It wasn't till Steve Jobs really showed us that a guy in his 20s could build a company as sizable as $2 billion did people really kind of wake up and say, hey, maybe this is a credible career path. And so I really consider Steve Jobs, rest his soul, as the guy that really launched the entrepreneur movement, at least in the United States, if not around the world.
Wow, that's true. And maybe awaken the belief that, wow, you know, I can do this. I'm passionate about this or that or whatever. And you know, I could make a business out of this as well. And so now how did you, Napoleon Hill talks about a definite purpose, and you probably didn't start out right from day one doing what you're doing. How did you evolve into the education and coaching that you do today? Because pretty amazing to have over 100 CEOs endorse a book and to have it in so many languages. And the things you're doing, pretty cool. The education program at MIT, you're doing some amazing things. How did you evolve into that? How did you decide that, wow, this is where my talent, my passion, my skill is?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was just talking to my four children. The oldest is 16, and both I gave him and my second son, who's 14, the magic of thinking big. But last night, I was literally talking to him about this guy, Ram Ramstad, one of the great entrepreneurial professors who had this theory called the corridor theory. And he said, look, what you really have to do is just start doing something and head down the corridor and then keep your eyes open to what doors might be available to you and then open them. And so that really, I wish I had that kind of grand plan. I was a mechanical engineer and was getting ready to go into the nuclear Navy and thought that was going to be the way I was going to see the world. And just before my interview with Rickover, I was called in by an entrepreneur, Dr. Fran Jabera, and he said, hey, why don't you join me and let's build the Center for Entrepreneurship out in Wichita. And he and I then co-founded this group called ACE, and the rest is history. So I went from thinking I was going to be in the nuclear Navy to all of a sudden in 82 putting together events to educate entrepreneurs and haven't looked back since. So it's kind of my 31st year of doing this stuff.
Wow, and this happens so much, and even I got it wrong when I was defining my definite purpose for my Napoleon Hill Leader Certification. I wrote it down, and then the director who knows me well said, Tom, that you're trying to be someone else. That's someone else's actual definite purpose. And so by a chance circumstance, if you believe in chance, you were actually able to come across this person who invited you to get involved in this totally different field. And so, wow, that's sometimes we stumble into our definite purpose. And then, as you said, from there, you just took it from there. But some of the things you've accomplished, was there one point when you were just starting out, like for me last year when I stood on the stage at Napoleon Hill International Convention, I told them, like, I've spoke to you like 27 for 27 years, but this is the first time I've actually been standing in front of you because I'd seen it for so long. Was there a part like when your book came out or when you had some CEO come up to you and say, like, wow, man, that was good? Is there something when you just started that you were like, wow, that was amazing?
You know, it was a moment where I had just started my MBA, and one of my marketing professor had a gig where he was doing an event for a hospital in St. Joseph, Missouri, and he couldn't do it, and he knew I was pretty good at speaking and those kind of things. So he said, hey, Vern, you want to go down and take this gig? And I'd actually had never done a paid gig. And I said, how much is it make? How much am I going to get paid? And he said, $1,000. I said, how long? Like for 3 hours. And I said, you know what? This is a good gig. And this is back in 82. I was kind of making $1,000 a month. And I said, wow, I can kind of make in 3 hours what it takes me all month to crank out. And, you know, the rest is history in terms of that part. So I think it's having mentors along the way that maybe recognize something in you that you're not even aware of, and they kind of nudge you in one of those doors that you might have missed as you're heading down the corridor, and that changes everything. But it's interesting. You mentioned chance or luck. My latest Growth Guy column is going to be talking about what I consider the five big concepts for 2013 and moving forward.
And nice.
One of them, I really feel, is the biggest concept of the 21st century so far. And it's an idea that Jim Collins put in his latest book, Great by Choice. And that was this idea of return on luck. He was really the first guy who studied luck. And we've all realized, particularly in our businesses, if not our lives, that 50% of it is luck.
Yeah.
So he wanted to see if the great companies had more or less good or bad luck. And what he discovered was this idea that, hey, they don't have any more or less. In fact, in many cases, they had slightly more bad luck. But what made the difference was their ability to get the best return on that luck. And I think that is such a powerful idea. And
wow.
I've thought about it ever since. And I tell you, that one idea has already, driven more incremental success in the last year since I first heard about it
wow.
than almost any other concept.
I never heard of that measured. So what would return on luck? Give a few examples or ideas of what that means. Does that mean like when you have good luck, you maximize every opportunity you can, and when bad luck comes, you as much as possible minimize or diminish the challenge that it causes.
Yeah, and see how if you can turn, lemons into lemonade. So for me specifically, Jim's on stage at our Fortune Summit. We're hosting him, and he says, okay, I want everyone to turn next to somebody and think about a time when, there was some luck, good or bad, and did you make the most of it or not? And I'm sitting there, and when I launched ACE, early participants in our events were Michael Dell. I met Michael his second year in business, and he came to our events every year. It's been neat.
Oh,
I've been
wow.
Recently mentoring his only son, Zach, which has been, quite an honor. Steve Jobs was there, and Mark Cuban, and there was a bunch of guys and gals building companies where literally, Tom, I could have put a few bucks in, and it would have been worth millions. But the luck was sitting right there, and I didn't grab a hold of it. So I'm sitting there in the room here all these years later, and I said, okay, who in this room do I know is going to be the next, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Michael Dell?
Yeah.
And a guy came immediately to mind, and I got up from my table in the, big ballroom, walked right across to him, and I said, Jeff, look, I'm not going to mess up again. And I said, I want to invest in your company. He said, well, it's funny, Vern, we're just closing on a $17 million round, and I'll let you in because, you've been a big part as an advisor to the to the company.
Wow.
But I didn't know you would be interested in investing. And I placed several of those bets last year, among other things, to where I think I can, hopefully get a better return on the luck that has presented itself to me.
Nice, nice. Very good. Now,
one of the flip side, associate George Oblaw that I knew well back in Wichita, there was the huge collapse of the oil industry back in the early 70s, and real estate collapsed, particularly in Houston. So he goes down and buys a building, and he turned it into storage because he said, the one thing people need when things have gone down is storage. And so he was able to weather the storm with that, and then when it came back, turn around and sold the building for a huge extra amount. So he was able to really get a great return on that bad luck.
Hmm. And this is such an important thing. That's one of Napoleon Hill's 17 principles, is learning from adversity and defeat. It's kind of like return on luck. And so, tremendous. I'm looking forward to that article. And also, I was thinking, you've hung around with and been around some really amazing business people. Have you been able to pick out, like, what is the most important habit of successful business leaders?
You know, there is, and it's something that struck me about John D. Rockefeller, and he even said it was the single most important thing to his success. It was something that Steve Jobs did, and it was something that Napoleon Hill spoke deeply about, and that was the daily or weekly mastermind. Simple as that. Now, Jim Collins years later called it the council in his book Good to Great. But the thing that really drove John D. Rockefeller's success is that he and his brother and these, you know, guys that had launched the company in Cleveland, Ohio, would walk to work together each day and walk home together each day. And he began to realize that all the really best decisions kind of happened on these walks and talks. So much so that when he moved to New York City, even though that inner circle had changed, he made sure that the senior leaders lived near enough to each other, close enough to Standard Oil's headquarters, they could continue to walk to work and walk home. And then he institutionalized this daily luncheon with his nine directors. And so his brain trust got considerable talk time every single day. Now, let's feed forward 100 years later. One of the top five business books I named for 2012 was Adam Leshinsky, my colleague at Fortune. Adam Leshinsky's book, Inside Apple. It really gives you the inside look of the business habits that made them successful. And it caught me totally by surprise, but it then didn't surprise me that one of the key habits of Steve Jobs, because design was literally the thing that was the driver for Apple, is that he and Jonathan Ive had lunch every single day. And he was really adamant about making sure that the senior team did not serve on other boards, weren't out giving a bunch of speeches, but basically stayed home at headquarters. And he would meet with them weekly, and he then every day, which was most of the days, spent time with his mastermind, the design team. And as a result, we've, you know, got the one of the highest wealth companies in the world.
T-Boone,
$3.2 million into $4 billion in 6 years after going almost broke. The key was his team huddles twice a day, you know, for breakfast every morning and then at the end of the day. So this mastermind, Goldman Sachs does the same thing, is critical, and I think it's the most important habit.
And as you know from Napoleon Hill's writing, Andrew Carnegie, this is like he flat out was pretty bold about saying he didn't know much at all about steel production. But he was pretty bold in saying he had the best people working around him, his mastermind team, and he picked the best people for each specific position, and he insisted on working in harmony, and that was the key to his success, is just the, you know, he got brilliant people around him, a lot of them way better than him at the production of steel, and this was the key to his success as well. And so it's important to, as you said, surround yourself with people that can, you know, be in your mastermind, be mentors, give you wise counsel. Is there a way to go out and find those people, approach those people? Because what I found is that a lot of successful people, they're fairly easy to approach, and they're almost always willing to help. And you would think busy people or successful people are A, too busy and to even get hold of, and be too busy to help. But have you picked out, or specifically as you were moving up your career, did you specifically seek out people to help you and be in your mastermind group and mentor you and give you advice?
Well, yes. And I want to distinguish between the two. I think it's critical that you have a mastermind that's able to meet at least once a week. I've got a group. They're actually my group of CEOs. We huddle every Monday, and it provides tremendous ideas and energy for all of us, which is different than the mentors and advisors I've had. I don't necessarily, bothering them, if I'll use that term, every week. It's much less frequent. So I think you need both. That mastermind that is close enough to you that you can meet with daily or weekly, as Steve Jobs and John D. Rockefeller and T. Boone Pickens and others have done. And then I think you need these advisors. And I've had them all along the way. When I launched ACE, besides Fran, I went down and befriended, and he's still a good friend today, Arthur Lipper. Arthur was running Venture Magazine at the time, and it was a leading publication in the business space. And so I just went down to go hear him speak. Got in the car, drove down from Wichita to Dallas, and walked up and met him. And I wrote actually an article about how you can hook these people to help you. But the quick thing is to get up to them and say, introduce yourself, tell them what you're, share your big vision. Hey, I want to build the world's largest student entrepreneurship organization. Put out something big, because that's what these guys and gals want to hear. And then you ask a question. So if you were me, what are the 10 things I need to be thinking about and doing? And then shut up and get a piece of paper out. They've got to see you writing it down, and write it all down, everything that they say. And I still have that yellow sheet of paper of all those ideas that Arthur at first just kind of rattled out. And then what you have to do immediately is go back and implement two or three of the ideas and then follow up about a week later. Back then it was, I had to send a letter, believe it or not. You have to follow up and say, hey, Mr. Lipper, you gave me 27 ideas. I've already implemented three of them, and I'm working on several more. I'll update you in a month. And then it's important for you to push back on one or two. They don't want you to be a minion agreeing with everything they say. They want there to be an intelligent being there. And so, hey, Arthur, I did three more things. I tried this one. It didn't work. I think here's why. And you've hooked them. They just want a great student. And then Bernie Goldhurst was that, the owner of Inc. magazine as I was building YEO. And then I've had a great relationship with Fortune magazine in building Gazelles. And I particularly have befriended Herman Simon, who kind of the world considers the Peter Drucker of Europe. And he's in Germany. I'm here in Barcelona, Spain. And he's become a great friend and mentor as well. So it's very important to have both.
Amazing. Now, you're really what I got out of mastering Rockefeller habits, and what you're so good at helping with is entrepreneurs and business people driving growth, generating growth in their business. Because in this day and age, even if you just stay level, you're really kind of falling behind. And so can you give us maybe two or three or four decisions and ideas about driving growth in a entrepreneurial, small business-based type company?
Yeah, sure, Tom. We have outlined what we think are four key decisions. And, there's a lot of decisions you got to make, but there's four biggies, and they're around people, strategy, execution, and cash. And so people are really the decisions you make, as we've been talking all along in this interview, about the people you choose to surround yourself with, who you decide to partner with, investors, the customers you choose to do business with, particularly early on, and obviously the employees and suppliers that you choose to work with. So you've got to get those people decisions right. Next, strategy. And your real indicator there is that your revenue continues to grow, because the market's telling you whether that you've got something they want or not. And if revenue starts to slow, the world's telling you, hey, you need to maybe adjust the strategy. Execution then is how you turn that revenue into profitability and time savings. And your indicator you got execution problems is, I see my friends triple the size of their company, but profitability didn't come with it. In fact, they're lamenting how they seem to have made more when it was just them and an assistant working out of their bedroom than it is now that they've got all these employees and customers. Or they're not getting real economies of scale with their time. They seem to be working harder today than they were 5 years ago. And if that's the case, if it feels like the bigger you get, the heavier anchor you're having to drag through the sand, then you've got real execution challenges. And then cash, you can get by with decent people, decent strategy, decent execution, but you can't get by a day without cash. You know, cash is king. And so you got to make sure you don't run out of it. So those are the four big decisions. We built some one-page tools that are complimentary up on the website and support for those tools that anyone in the world can use. And we've got tens of thousands of companies doing that.
Amazing. And this is so helpful. There's so many entrepreneurs and business people that they dream of starting a business. And, you know, this is an amazing thing where entrepreneurs are the fuel of any economy at any time. However, once they start working, they find they're working like 70, 80 hours a week. They're working harder, longer hours than they ever worked. And although you may be passionate about your business, you can't have it destroying your life and your health and your relationships. And so I found with the strategies that you give in your book and in some of your training, it allows a small business owner or entrepreneur to kind of regain his life and still drive growth, which is probably an amazing combination for people to realize, okay, I don't have to work 80 hours a week and stress out my whole life and whole family, and I can still drive growth at the same time. And that's not only helping the business, this is helping the person as well.
And live in Barcelona, Spain.
You know, yeah.
Kind of where you want to go and live where you want to live. You know, our big purpose and mine personally is freedom. And I think it's why people go into business for themselves, is the independence and the freedom. And they can quickly find just the opposite if they're not careful. And so we want them to kind of help them ultimately get that freedom back so they can make the choices to live where they want to and spend time where they want to and not feel, you know, kind of chained down by their business.
Exactly. Otherwise, it's worse than having a job because now you're chained down, you have so many responsibilities, and you're the ultimate decision maker. So if you don't reclaim your life, it can become not so fun. And so, as you said, freedom, but then also I think with a lot of the systems you help with business owners with, it also gives them some predictability of their business, that they have an idea today what the revenues are going to be like 3, 6, 9 months down the road, so that you can start redirecting things that are off track today rather than getting 9 months down the road and saying, what? I didn't know I was off track that much.
Yeah, we have a phrase that really drives everything we do, which is that routine actually sets you free. You know, people don't think about it that way. You know, John D. Rockefeller was very disciplined. He was a devout Baptist. He was an accountant by training. You know, this isn't a guy you'd want to party with a lot, but he was tremendously disciplined. And by the way, Jim Collins, 100 years later in his book Good to Great, said you really got to do three things. You got to have disciplined people engaged in disciplined thinking through disciplined action. And the key word there was discipline. And the way we tie that to freedom is that these disciplines will actually set you free. And that has proved to be the case.
Exactly. And now the book you wrote, The Greatest Business Decisions of All Times, Jim Collins wrote the foreword. That's pretty amazing to have Jim Collins write the foreword of a book. I've read all his books, and they're very powerful. So can you go through some of those great business decisions, the greatest business decisions of all times?
Yeah, it was actually Steve Jobs' death that spurred me to write the book, actually. I was in India with our partner there. I just finished up a tour and lamenting Steve's death, you know, as the guy I think really was the ambassador for the young entrepreneur movement. And he and I got reflective on, you know, what an amazing decision it was for the board of directors of Apple to bring him back. I mean, it's never been done in the history of business. Founded the company, grew up to $2 billion, fired essentially, gone for 10 years, comes back and does the greatest work of his life and creates the wealthiest company on the planet. And that got us thinking, hey, I wonder what the other ones are. So we named 18 of them in the book, and we didn't put them in any order except the what we felt was the best, the number one decision, so we put it in the last chapter. But I have my personal top five, and so I'm happy to kind of touch on them. But quickly, number five was Jack Welch at GE. In the midst of having to let 100,000 people go, it's never fun. But when he took over back in the early 80s, he had to do that, but at the same time decided to spend $50 million building a first-class, world-class executive education center called Crotonville. And he got highly criticized for it, you know, as you can imagine. And so he asked the guy from Harvard that was running his education program at the time to try to do an ROI calculation, return on investment. He did all these calculations. And my favorite story in the book is you know, the guy running the thing brings him the calculations. Jack's kind of looking through them, and he looks to the final page what the result was, and he thought about it, and he scratched it out, and he just wrote the word infinite. He realized that that education's return is infinite, and if you don't believe that, then you know, then you're not going to value it. And so I thought it was a powerful decision. What's interesting is 30 years later, what was the last thing Steve Jobs focused on the last 2 years of his life? And that was building Apple University, because he knew it was the most important thing he needed to leave behind if Apple was had any chance at all of succeeding. And so that number five was really emphasizing the power of executive education and making it sexy, which he did. Number four was an amazing decision by Samsung. And I think Samsung's recently been in the news because they're the only company giving Apple a run for its money. And folks don't realize it's the seventh largest company in the world, $250 billion in revenue. I haven't seen the latest 2012 numbers yet, so it's probably up above that. And it comes out of a little country, South Korea. You know, how did this happen? And in 1990, their chairman made a very bold decision, and that was to get outside of South Korea. You know, they were a very insular country, believed in only learning Korean. They said that if we believe that, we're going to fail. And so he started an initiative where he chose 400 young people a year out of the company, put them in a three-month intensive program where they would learn a different language someplace on the planet, and then stick them out there for a year. To date, they've done that with 4,700 people. And my favorite story there in the book is they'd sent a young Korean to Russia. And you were allowed just to kind of goof off and learn the culture and how things worked in that country for a year. You weren't doing any business. And at the end, you're to write up a report. And so the young Korean writes up his 80-page report. And there wasn't a word about Samsung or its products or services. It was basically 80 pages on the drinking habits of the Russians. And, you know, but it really proved he got who they were. And the rest is history. He came went on to run Samsung in Russia, and Samsung's products became leaders in every one of the categories they were in. And the problem in the United States is we're so stuck in our own world that we're missing the rest of it. So I called that my fourth biggest decision. The third was the decision that Sam Walton made in his first store in Walmart. I mean, here you got the largest company in the world from a revenue standpoint. Again, I haven't seen their 2012 numbers yet. They're not out, but probably close to $500 billion, first company to hit that. Whoa. And what was the key? He had started this meeting. This his first mastermind, really, was with his employees every Saturday morning, and he would say, hey, what did you learn? And this is so progressive for a leader to even think his retail employees would have thoughts and ideas that would be helpful, because that's not using the mentality of a business owner, you know, particularly back in that era. Let's be forward decades later, and it's a habit they continued for decades where – you know, they would spend most of their week talking to employees, talking to customers, shopping competitors, come back Thursday night. They had this stand-up meeting. They have a stand-up meeting Friday where they pour over what they learn, and their goal is to make changes by noon Saturday. In their view, if they can improve the company 1% every week, compound interest will be their friend. And so we get into the details of that, but it was that important kind of early mastermind that they have maintained. Number two decision was obviously Apple bringing Steve Jobs back. We've talked about that, and there was an interesting story in the book about how that conversation actually came to be. It had nothing to do with the leadership at Apple or Steve. It was a mid-manager who actually caused it to happen. And then the number one decision, which we were always clear about. We could have debated all the rest in the order, but this one was clearly number one. It not only changed the company, it changed the industry, and it created the wealthiest country on the planet, the U.S. And that was Henry Ford deciding overnight in 1914 to double wages from $2.50 to $5 a day. And it was the first time that labor was viewed not as just an input into the manufacturing process, but something you invest in. And how important it was then to create a market for your products and services. And so, again, not only did it propel Ford, that one decision propel Ford way ahead of everybody else, allowed them to attract the very best talent by the droves, which is what everybody was hurting for back then.
Created
customers and really propelled the industrial age of the United States. So, and by the way, speed forward all these, 100 years later, and Foxconn's having to do the same thing in China. We're seeing the same thing in India, literally doubling of wages. And one of my favorite stores, the Container Store. It won every award we've had in the United States on Best Place to Work that we've given at Fortune magazine. They're a retailer, selling closet organizers and garage organizers, and they literally pay their retail employees twice as much as industry average. And so these decisions still are applicable in the 21st century.
And amazing. Henry Ford is whom Napoleon Hill wrote about more than any other single person. And yet he wasn't like a Harvard MBA or anything, but he came up, Napoleon Hill talks about that one specific thing a lot. And not only did it was an amazing decision, it also created customers for the company, because how loyal are you to a company that's paying you double what you could get somewhere else? Of course, there wasn't a lot of competition for him back then, but so many amazing decisions that this one man made because he had a strong, strong, definite purpose. And I always love that Napoleon Hill wrote so kindly of Henry Ford's wife as well. He said that was Henry Ford and Thomas Edison, the mastermind with their wives, is really what made them famous and wealthy and brought so much of their success. So, yeah, I love that story about Henry Ford, and that is, and now that you've gone through them, it's like, yeah, what other decision really rocked the world and made such a change in a business as that one decision? So very cool. I'm going to have to get that book myself because I want to read the other 13 stories as well. And I love what you said about Jack Welch in the book In Search of Excellence. They said that the companies that invested the most in training also had the best returns financially. And so good correlation there, that the more you invest in your people, the more it's going to show up on your bottom line in the terms of profit.
You bet.
Wow. Thank you so much, Vern. I appreciate it. I was a little bit nervous. Some of these interviews, I get nervous because you've done so much. You've done so amazingly well and such a great service. You're helping entrepreneurs and small business people of the world, and those are the people that drive every economy. Maybe big companies get more news, but the entrepreneurs are the ones who drive the economies of the world. And so you're really helping them to fulfill their passions and their dreams, but also to impact the world as well. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Have yourself an amazing 2013.
Will do. And thank you for helping spread the word, Tom. That's equally important. You bet.
Take care.
Bye-bye.